Now, comrades and fellow workers, a little quiet please, because we're now going to engage ourselves in a very important thing, I would imagine, where Richard Hedeker addresses us on this stateless society. This is part of this reappraisal or another look at William Morris's ideas. And amongst some of those ideas, we have already examined Morris's relationship to Marx's ideas. We've even looked at it in relation to Morris's ideas about art. For some inexplicable but quite exciting moments, we've looked at Morris's idea about sex. I don't know how that came about, but some members quite liked it, didn't they? They don't get out much. Anyway, here is Richard Hedeker on the Stateless Society, where I think he's going to have a look, perhaps from a different view than it's usually done. And after it, when all the members and sympathisers and opponents get angry, I'm going to be the chairman. This is the bit I'm looking forward to, Richard. Richard Hedeker on the Stateless Society.
Because that's what I've told him, and it's a total lie. As many of you know, I have arrived at socialism by the scenic route. And so far as I know, there is absolutely no connection with socialist ideas in my family tradition, and most definitely not within my own family experience. My father was first a judge's marshal, that's the bloke who puts the black cap on when they sentence people to death. And then he was for 29 years secretary of the Allied Engineering Employers Association. He did have two brothers with whom I had brief contact after he died, Frank and Jim. Both of them were high Tories, and Jim, who I liked best, as he introduced me to a daring and rather speculative publication, and now much missed, called The Sporting Life, and sometime later became a Jehovah's Witness. Whether or not this constituted an improvement is appropriately enough a matter for some speculation. Both Frank and Jim were married and had children, one of whom, during the 80s, was running a department store, Hannington's, in Brighton. I need say no more than that the wall of his office was adorned, if that's the word I want, with a huge portrait of Margaret Thatcher. By then, I was well established as the family misfit and had long considered myself to be an anarchist. Given this staunchly conservative upbringing, my dad even expected us to stand up for the national anthem if it was played on the radio when we were sitting around at home. I hope you will receive the confession that I now make in a true socialist spirit of forgiveness and understanding. Honesty compels me to admit that until I was asked if I was interested in giving this talk, I had never taken the time properly to read much other than snippets of the works of William Morris. So I stand before you, almost virgin. Anyway, my mind, of course, was too much occupied for too long a time in other directions. And to be fair to myself, I think it's at least unlikely that many of you are deeply acquainted with the kind of literary masterpieces that absorbed my interest. Such red-hot bestsellers as Nuclear, Biological and Chemical Warfare on the Modern Battlefield and the unbearably thrilling Space Weapons US Strategy Origins and Development, with its positively enthralling chapter, The First Phase of Satellite Interceptor Tests, and the even more dangerously exciting The Resumption of Asset Testing and the Debate Over Soviet Beam Weapon Programme. Though, on reflection, knowing you lot, there's probably a couple of smart asses here who've read both of them. However, over the past few months, I have read only William Morris or books about him, except for an odd glance at the Racing Post. And I have to say that I have been amongst the most rewarding and enlightening of my life. And I roundly curse, not for the first time, the years I had lost buried in the nuclear wasteland. The stateless society, however, is a concept which I had embraced for many years, long before I joined the Socialist Party in 1987. It has been the steadfast constant that has informed and sustained my personal and political commitment for almost 40 years. Frankly, not everything that Morris advocated so fervently meets with my uncritical approval, which disagreement, I am sure, would have pleased him no end. And in one or two areas, his understandable zeal seemed a little too close to obsession for my taste. Though strangely, I loved him more because of that. But concerning the stateless society, something he regarded as desirable, necessary, practical, and achievable, I found him persuasive, logical, and inspiring. Since I had heard a number of assertions in the past that Morris was not a true socialist, though many more that he certainly was, I was delighted to discover that his perception of the stateless society emphatically embraced the three most fundamental elements comprising the socialist ideal. Firstly, that it should be democratic. When I spoke here last year on democracy, I suggested that it was not enough to regard it as some mere administrative structure that needs only to be conscientiously conceived and established to ensure its success as a regulating mechanism. But it was first, crucially important, that its very essence of principled and graceful conciliation should pervade the everyday interaction between members of any community aspiring to it. That it needed to be manifested as a personal attitude, integrated into our philosophy, morality, lifestyle, call it what you will, as individuals, before it could be realistically expected to function effectively as an acceptable arbiter of social disputes without having to resort to the kind of overriding, some kind of overriding authority. And Morris saw this very clearly. And if only I'd bothered to read him sooner, my brain would not be hurting so much now. Every place visited in News from Nowhere is veritably imbued with this democratic spirit, with a charming, though frequently highly opinionated manner of exchanging vigorous points of view, but always displaying a deep and mutual respect for the right to differ. Listen to the beautiful way Morris explains it in News from Nowhere. Said I, "And you settle these differences, great and small, by the will of the majority, I suppose." "Certainly," said he. "How else could we settle them? You see, in matters which are merely personal, which do not affect the welfare of the community, how a man shall dress, what he shall eat and drink, what he shall write and read, and so forth, there can be no difference of opinion, and everybody does as he pleases. But when the matter is of interest to the whole community, and the doing or not doing something affects everybody, the majority must have their way. In a society of men who are free and equal, the apparent majority is the real majority, and the others, as I have hinted before, know too well to obstruct for mere pig-headedness, especially as they have plenty of opportunity of putting forward the own side of the question." Morris was also well aware that democracy could not be left to mature on its own like a good wine, which we shall be drinking later. More like my tennis, to keep it working properly, it requires continual practice. This is something we try to do, of course, in the Socialist Party, and it would be foolish to claim that it is easy. Since we assert that the stateless society is a viable proposition and recognise that democracy is essential to its function. We are obliged to work at it now to better understand the complexity, difficulties and complications that can arise. Unquestionably, even in the most enlightened society, these will sometimes create dissatisfaction and frustration for minorities. To deny the possibility, perhaps even the likelihood of such a problem, would be to display an absurd complacency. Precisely because the society relies upon the cooperation of free and sometimes awkward individuals. As Maurice Riley observes in a letter to Commonweal on the 5th of May in 1889, experience shows us that wherever a dozen thoughtful men shall meet together, there will be 12 different opinions on any subject, and we shall find that out later in the lounge tonight, I've not the slightest doubt. On any subject, which is not a dry matter of fact, and often on that too. Anarchists, of course, might argue that democracy, in the democracy, the majority actually constitutes the authority. And Maurice concedes that for what it's worth, it might be so defined. But when free human beings, uncoerced, voluntarily enter into a process where a prolonged and open debate concludes with a majority decision, to call it authority is the logic of the absurd. And to call it tyranny, with all the oppressive connotations held by such a word, makes complete nonsense of language. In the same letter, Morris offers another particularly astute insight, which anarchists and others would do well to ponder. Surely, he says, in speculating on the future of society, we should try to shake ourselves clear of mere phrases, especially of as many of them will cease to have a meaning when the change comes that we all long for. And then a dagger thrust is delivered. And here, he says, I join issue with our anarchist communist friends, who are somewhat authoritative on the matter of authority, and not a little vague also. For if freedom from authority means the assertion of the advisability or possibility of an individual man doing what he pleases in all circumstances, this is an absolute negation of society. Morris quickly acknowledges that many anarchists might indeed add a qualification, well, any sensible ones would, that in pursuing their own freedom, they would naturally consider the effect of their actions upon others. Thus conceding any concept of freedom inevitably must include constraint. Like all socialists, Morris rightly perceived that democracy, if the need for the word still exists in a stateless society, is not diminishing freedom, but enhancing it. Secondly, Morris makes it equally clear that a stateless society can only be a leaderless society. In a splendidly succinct sentence, again from News from Nowhere, he explains that leaders have no role in socialist democracy. He writes, a man no more needs an elaborate system of government with its army, navy, and police to force him to give way to the will of his equals than he wants a similar machinery to make him understand that his head and a stone wall cannot occupy the same place at the same moment. I loved all his little jokes like that, you know, it's full of them. Unfortunately, the idea that members of our society could coexist harmoniously without any kind of government or leader is dismissed by most people as being absolutely impossible. And I suppose that is understandable. For the self-belief that most human beings has been severely undermined by the callous, exploitative, and authoritarian system in which we live. Afraid of freedom, they seek security in conformity, resulting in a vast division between the few who are expected to make the decisions and the many who are expected to obey. An unhealthy and oppressive state of affairs, largely, alas, accepted as not only normal, but immutable as well. For the state, of course, with its various attendant organizations and institutions, established to uphold a hierarchical social system based on domination and privilege, such acquiescence is immensely gratifying. For to maintain the status quo, it requires citizens to be dependent, uniform, and compliant. It feels safest if its inhabitants can be kept on a low level of personal development, which can be controlled by authority. It orchestrates an unceasing propaganda campaign designed to reinforce the illusion. This illusion, the vast majority of people choose to conform, to obey rather than question, to believe rather than think. And in their anxiety not to be seen as different, let alone as self-asserting and rebellious, they substantially suppress the shared human capacity to be free, discriminating, responsible, and sympathetic beings. Those who do assert themselves and disturb the function of the state are quickly labelled cranks, freaks, rebels, or fools. And if they persist, are in danger of being contained, suppressed, removed, imprisoned, or even eliminated. Morris saw through all of this and rightly identified the only possible basis for creating an enduring socialist society as strong, independent, free individuals. This perception lies at the heart of all his practical and speculative thought and appears as a constantly reoccurring theme. He expresses it with specific passion in his lecture, The Society of the Future. Therefore, he says, my ideal of the society of the future is first of all freedom and cultivation of the individual will, which civilization ignores or even denies the existence of. The shaking off of slavish dependence, not on other men, but on artificial systems made to save men manly trouble and responsibility. And later, in the same lecture, like any speaker familiar with the first principles of homiletics, he repeats it for emphasis. So then, my ideal is first unconstrained life, and next simple and natural life. First, you must be free, and next, you must learn to take pleasure in all the details of life, which indeed will be necessary for you, because since others will be free, you will have to do your own work. Morris unerringly penetrated the bogus notion, universally disseminated, to justify state control, that men and women can only cooperate if by some means or other they are coerced. One of the most pernicious untruths ever perpetrated is that there is some kind of unbridgeable chasm between independence and cooperation. What nonsense. Strong, independent individuals will not wish to isolate themselves in a community which they have created? What an absurdity. And it is not free individuals who cause and practice the violence and corruption and greed that are inherent in capitalism, but those who are, alas, unfree. On the contrary, when human beings are free, they will possess a much greater awareness of choice and more deeply understand the liberating dynamic of their creative potential. And when this brilliant power that we all possess to externalize our imagination is no longer frustrated, it will be truly revolutionary for our behavior. And thirdly, Morris envisaged a moneyless society. He positively despised the economic exploitation and ruthless profiteering of capitalism. In his lecture, The Lesser Arts, he cannot conceal his contempt. Is there money to be gathered? Cut down the pleasant trees among the houses. Pull down the ancient and venerable buildings for the money that a few square yards of London dirt will fetch. Blacken rivers, hide the sun and poison the air with smoke or worse. And it's nobody's business to see it or to mend it. That is all that modern commerce, the counting house, forgetful of workshop, will do for us herein. What a stunning condemnation. And later, in his lecture, Art Under Plutocracy, he compares what he calls the mask of competitive commerce with war. And this is absolutely chilling, I found. It made my blood go cold. I tell you, the very essence of competitive commerce is waste. The waste that comes of the anarchy of war. Do not be deceived by the outside appearance of order in our plutocratic society. It fares with it as it does with the older forms of war, that there is an outside look of quite wonderful order about it. How neat and comforting the steady march of the regiment. How quiet and respectable the sergeants look. How clean the polished cannon. Neat, neat as a new pin are the storehouses of murder. Stunning, absolutely stunning. There are many, of course, who've launched scathing attacks upon crass commercialism and the economics of profit without actually advocating a moneyless society. But none among them, so far as I'm aware, who advocated the kind of democratic, leaderless community described by Morris in News from Nowhere. For the existence of money would inevitably compromise such concepts. Members of the Green Party, for instance, are forever castigating the immorality of capitalism and the obscenity of production for profit. Their desire for a less exploitative, less polluted and fairer society is doubtless sincere. But their economic policies often remind me of the children's card game, Little Grey Rabbit, with cards like Owl Gets Three for helping hedgehog safely across the road. Green economics is quite similar. Give Jonathan a tax cut for not driving his car too much. Or more negatively, J. Bonington Jagworth is fined £1,000 for not using unleaded petrol in his Boggs Super Oaf Mark II. But the harsh reality remains that it is utterly impossible to play Little Grey Rabbit on the monopoly board of capitalism. And it never will be possible. Money can never be just a means of exchange. Its presence is a curse upon any society, and invariably it leads to the most ludicrous excesses. Within the space of the past month, there have been three spectacular examples of this excess. When the new Sanderson Hotel opened in Berners Street, I cancelled my reservation immediately when I discovered that a flute of house champagne, mark you, was £50. Then, the next day, I read that the menu at the Caviar House in Piccadilly was offering, here's a snip, if I'll give you the address if you're interested afterwards, albino beluga, that's the albino beluga whale, which is practically extinct anyway, albino beluga caviar, 125 grams, quarter of a pound to you and me, £1,838. I mean, it is ludicrous, isn't it? And only yesterday, I read that some twerp was going to pay in an internet auction £101,000 for Mrs. Thatcher's handbag. Admittedly, that was for charity, but these sort of things are, this is typical, isn't it, of the nonsense of the money society.
Was it Christian Neal?
It may have been. No, it wasn't, actually. It was an American, you might be surprised to hear. But most important is, of course, is the devastating misery caused every day in capitalism by either the lack of money or the hunger for it. The power and privilege it buys spell certain death to any possibility of leaderless democracy. Truth to tell, three and a half years before his death in his lecture, Communism, impatient with progress towards socialism, and persuaded that some kind of public ownership may, after all, be a useful role in the transition to socialism, Morris did resort to comments like the utmost an acquisitive man could do would be to induce his fellow citizens to pay him extra for his special talent. And the captain and the stoker would have the same pay. But, it would be a mean-spirited mistake to permit this to detract from the abiding and enchanting manner which, in News from Nowhere, he illustrates his understanding that a socialist society would most certainly be moneyless. Firstly, when the guest offers Dick the Waterman some money, he seemed puzzled, but not at all offended, and he looked at the coins with some curiosity. Therewith my friend said thoughtfully, "I think I know what you mean. You think I have done you a service, so you feel yourself bound to give me something which I am not to give to a neighbour unless he has done something special for me." I have heard of this kind of thing, but pardon me for saying that it seems to us a troublesome and roundabout custom, and we don't know how to manage it. And then later, obtaining that elaborate pipe from the shop, "But however am I going to pay for such a thing as this?" Dick laid his hand on my shoulder as I spoke, and turning, I met his eyes with a comical expression in them, which warned me against another exhibition of extinct commercial morality. Wonderful. Socialists are always being called dreamers. Indeed, Morris so described himself. But he was no idle dreamer. Donald Soper, the Methodist minister who used to speak in the park, once described most of his congregation of being so wrapped up in heaven that they were no earthly use. But that was not the kind of dreamer that Morris was. He was the supreme inspiring example of how conscious idealism could inform and energize practical living. What a dismal misjudgment to think that all dreams must be pure fantasy. The philosopher Thoreau, and here I hold up my philosophy hostility detector in this room, because I know there's a few of you, and it's pretty high, wrote this. It's quite good, actually. "Millions are awake enough for physical labour, but only one in a million is awake enough We must learn to reawaken and keep ourselves awake, not by mechanical aids, but by an infinite expectation of the dawn. Beautiful. When I spoke here 3 years ago on how we might live, I quoted a wonderful line from a Rodgers and Hart song. Wide awake, we can make our most fantastic dreams come true. Well, here's an even better one from a song written not by Rodgers and Hart, but Elvis Presley, because my new flatmate's an Elvis Presley fan, and I think Elvis has a brilliant voice. And it's all about, rather like imagine, the possibility of living in a better world. And it contains this stunning line, for as long as we have the strength to dream, as long as we have the strength to dream. What a great line. I'm just about to end. Last page, you'll all be relieved to know. Thinking of what might be, recognizing the hope of human potential is by no means airy, fairy dross. We should welcome the fact that in an increasingly artificial, superficial, and often downright brutal capitalist society, it is often our dreams alone that speak of our reality. And here is another philosopher warning, this time from Emerson. When the act of reflection takes place in the mind, when we look at ourselves in the light of thought, we discover our life is embosomed in beauty. Morris, as I said, was no idle dreamer, but he was never afraid to dream. His utopia, he never claimed to be anything more than a product of his own abstract thought combined with his practical political insight. But he left us a legacy that shows us all the wisdom of learning to live, but still daring to dream. And we must never, never, never allow this priceless legacy to be lost to the lunatic world of phony realism.